This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you if people send you the same generic conversation starters they message everyone else? Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
The book, Before I Leave You, a memoir on suicide, addiction, and healing, is finally out to the public. What started as a note, originally meant as a goodbye letter by Rob Imbo, turned into a book, an apology, therapy, and a healing tool to turn things around. The book is a redemption story, an introduction into repressed memory and childhood trauma, a harsh reality of the darker side of Las Vegas, and a reality check of how addicts manage to hide their struggle, their troubles, and their illness from colleagues, family, and friends. Some of you may be familiar with Rob's name, as he was one of the founding partners for Ascent Compliance, which I'm learning is pretty much valued at about $500 million these days, a company involved in revolutionizing supply chain data collection and risk management. He did all of that while struggling with substance abuse issues. We talk about his healing, his early practices of meditation, a clean lifestyle and a clean diet, yoga, writing, and books, all which helped change his trajectory. Now a married father of two, this story will give you hope. It will give you knowledge and understanding of the internal battle people face and hopefully will inspire others to find the courage to help push through. So welcome to Living Your Life with Leanne Lang, the podcast brought to you by Extension Marketing. And for more information, you can always check out extensionmarketing.com. Okay, Rob, I got through the intro. We good?
Yeah. Wow. Wonderful.
So this isn't our first time kind of sitting and chatting. I will tell people that I have read the book from cover to cover, but more so because I wanted to be able to help you, because having this story come out, it was pretty much having your entire life unfold. And it's kind of like, how on earth am I going to tell this story?
Yeah, for sure. That's why I reached out. I was extremely nervous having interviews like this, and you're a consummate professional, and you were posting things like watch your, you know, the way you sit. I'm like, I think I need to reach out. And I heard your 100th episode, and that blew me away because you were so vulnerable, and that was the day I reached out.
So, and it was I was very honored and touched that you did, especially with something that hadn't quite gone public yet. The book, no one had really, I think I was one of the first few people to actually read the book. And I think I was honored because this was going to be a story that you were going to need to practice and figure out and find the courage to be able to get into interview settings, whether they're a quick 4-minute live interview on TV or a long podcast version, to be able to know where the emotions can go and what information you can get out and how to get people interested in what it was that you're the story that you were trying to share.
Yeah, that's a big part of it, because I'm a crier, especially with you know, two young daughters, and to talk about, you know, the subject matter that I talk about in the book, and to where do those emotions go.
Okay, this is probably going to be a bit of an emotional ride for a lot of people, and for me too, because I actually just saw, like, this was the first time I actually got to touch the book, was just, you know, 10 minutes before we started to record. What is it actually like to see this book now? Like, it was one thing to see the manuscript on the computer screen, but to hold it and see it out,
It got delivered to my mother's house, and she opened it and she saw the picture of young me on the cover, and she just broke down in tears. So, as did I just started crying too. Just like, we had that idea for the cover, like the designer gave me this inspiration and really suggested I be on the cover. And then when I suggested the little me, she was blown away. And yeah, seeing it is really, it's really emotional for sure.
Just to even see it and not even mom, open
my,
it.
My mom has the first copy and she's kissing it every day. She kisses the little me every day.
I think she kisses it because you're here. It's that she's able to kiss something that's still living and breathing, and is a different feeling for her, knowing that what was originally a suicide attempt didn't work, and that with it came the courage to write this.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she didn't know. She had no idea. She saw me living the glamorous life and going to Vegas and posting those fun photos. And she knew about the ecstasy a little bit. And I said, oh, it's fine. You know, I've done my research. And but she had no idea what was going on. And so when she read it, it was definitely a trauma for her.
What would you say, as so people are going to kind of get into this, and we've worked on this, but if someone was like, okay, this is your book, Rob, what's your book about? What's going to be your standard answer?
My standard answer, as we've discussed, to be honest, in the early stages of building this company, that memory of being raped as an 8-year-old boy just sort of surfaces and kind of blindsides me, and I don't know what to do with it. I leave my wife, and I start just partying to die. And think Leaving Las Vegas. I was very much inspired by that movie, and spending as much as I possibly can, spending all my savings and hitting rock bottom in a few places, but somehow, messing up, not I'm not able to commit suicide, and holding on and clawing my way back to a place where I am now. And you know me now, I'm in love with life. I know I have two beautiful girls, and I have an amazing wife. So that's what the story is about.
Yeah, like you are the epitome of loving life. I mean, healthy, you know, vibrant, active, like this wonderful perception and kind of value to what you give life. So I hope that people will feel that and feel inspired. And I think when I asked you, you know, well, who is this book really for? That's kind of like, there's going to be a lot of people that will take something different from your story.
Yeah, it could be for a lot of people. I mean, I wrote it for me in that situation, because I read books in that, for like addiction books, and how they managed to get through it. So it's to give people hope, and maybe people whose loved ones are going through what they fear I was going through, to how to give them the safe space so they can heal. And also for people who like to read this kind of story, right? This journey of addiction and getting us and healing, especially.
You know, it takes a lot. I mean, it takes one thing to be able to write something, but when you talk about the fact that you read a lot of books, mm-hmm. were there people that helped inspire you? Like, was there a style once you realized you were writing, you were starting to write quite a bit? Where did the words come from, or did you have a sense of where you were going to be going with this?
I think when you described it in the beginning, when I did share it, and some people encouraged me to share the story as an outward project, as an actual book, I Googled best memoirs, and I found Cheryl Strayed's Wild. I didn't know that it was a movie. I just found that the book, the words are so, like, her writing is so amazing. It's intimidating for sure. And then looking to, you know, Sarah Hepola's Blackout and Holly Mary Carr's, like, you know, Liars Club, those really stood out as beautiful memoirs. And I wanted to do the best I can in the writing.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Are you ready to dig into the book?
Sure.
Okay. So
where's the Kleenex?
Okay, we're gonna have Veronica go in and run and get some. That's so true. I hadn't even known. Yeah, I'm gonna probably be a mess too. Okay. Because I mentioned in this right off the top, because it was something that I had to look into a little bit when we're talking about repressed memory, is to understand a little bit more, you know, about it and being confused by it and how exactly does this happen. So I think that it wasn't the launching point right off the bat in the book, but we get a sense early on that that a lot of the issues, everything stems from this. And I would think as a man who hadn't quite talked about it a lot, we're going to be going back to childhood trauma, which we can all seem to think we can run away from, and we can't.
We can't. And it, no matter how you think, and I thought, that talking about it's not going to help. It certainly is going to help. You know, it manifests in so many different ways. Like, I mean, repressed memory itself is somewhat controversial. It's accepted in my area of childhood sexual trauma, I'm not advocating for either side. But my story was that, and I believe that this is common. Is I knew that there was something there. And it informed who I became. It informed who how I behaved, how I spoke, and all the acting out I did. And it tormented me my entire life. I just didn't know. And I described it as we've spoken about before. It was a kind of like a out of focus photograph from the 70s, and it turned into a full length high definition 4K movie.
When it clicks.
when it came back.
When it came back. So, came back, you know, when people talk about, you know, the repressed memory, is that, and I liked it, it was like this blurry gray, you know, black and white vision of things.
Yeah.
And it always constantly in the back of your mind, like lingering.
For me, like, I knew someone was in the room that night and I knew something happened. And it tormented me for, like, when I boxed, you know, with my partners, and I would stay those late nights and want to, okay, I need to do 1,000 jabs. Okay, I need to do 1,000 overhead rights. I was tormenting myself and I had no idea why I was so angry. It comes out. It comes out in anger. It comes out in disassociation. You just don't want to be a part of the world. You're constantly tired. It comes out in so many ways, and your physiology too, right? You're comforting yourself through food, through alcohol, through addictions. All addictions lead back to a trauma, right?
And it did. And so, yeah, we'll talk about your boxing, because that'll bring us to different levels and different things that you've actually since then have kind of established. But so you talk about this. It's there's that feeling someone's in the room, and yet what was that trigger that brought it to a full-length movie, 4K in full color, that it was just vividly right there?
I think it was a bit of, I describe it in the book because I was actually reading a book that triggered it. But the context of my life was, I was in a loving relationship. I was very happy, and I think we were even thinking about having kids. And I think when I read that passage in the book, it just clicked, and it just sent me spiraling. I'm like, and I even said the words out loud, you know, and it had not, I mean, it was in God Is Not Great by Christopher Hitchens, and they were describing a stoning of a woman who, for whatever reason, I was like, I can't believe they did that to that woman. And I actually said out loud, is that I can't believe they would do that or to a little boy. And my wife's like, what? And then it all just came back. It just literally just came flooding back like a tidal wave. I ran to the washroom and I was catatonic for a couple of days.
Okay. Like the physical toll, like it was like a release, like the, your entire body.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everything was triggered.
I just was vomiting. I curled up around the toilet for hours and hours. And my wife is just sort of stroking my hair, trying to figure out what's going on.
And are you able to express it? Are you able to?
It took a while. It took a while to actually articulate what I saw. And I knew it was true. It just sort of like there, you know?
You speak of like a catatonic state. Is it you just don't want to move? Is it it's the fear of actually getting up and having to face it now that it's in front of you?
It's just not wanting to be anymore. Just not wanting to be anything. Just stop. Like, just this is why it turned into suicide, right? So, I just don't want to live. Just don't want to. You see that type of violence and that type of, you know, I'll say torture. It just, you don't understand. You can't reconcile. You know, I'm kind of a happy-go-lucky person, and I just can't reconcile the cruelty.
I'm just let you breathe for a second. Because you speak beautifully about it. I can tell with the words and the writing, the way you've been able to express yourself even in talking about it right now. But 8-year-old boy, family, not like a family friend. It was
I mean, so mom was going through, I guess, a separation. She was single and she was an alcoholic back then. And there were a few suitors that came back. And we tried to figure out who, and we can't figure out who specifically. We've definitely ruled people out. We don't know who.
But I'd like to mention this because your mom might be trying to figure it out now with you, but you didn't say anything as an 8-year-old boy. And I'm going to say it because I've read it and I think it might be too difficult for you. But I think for me, I actually had to stop reading. Well, I know I stopped reading because I remember sitting in a chair for about 7 hours straight reading this book. But the image of this image of an 8-year-old boy walking with bloody sheets to go to the washing machine so that no one would see. I really had to, especially as a parent, like I had to put the book down and just kind of take a couple minutes. Maybe because I knew where the story was going to be going, I needed to give it a chance to sink in to understand just how much trauma and the violence that you would have had to endure as a young child for that. And that, for me, that you didn't go and tell mom, that your first thing wasn't to go run and get help. And just that was my first impression, was just to see how inward this was going to go, like how secretive and inside this dark ghost and horrific experience was going to live in the core of your soul. That was for me. And then at the same time, like shaking it, like why didn't you go? For sure. Do you question, like, do you remember? And I know in reading it, but like why you didn't go for help at the time?
It's something we obviously breached in therapy, and it's like my young mind, A, can't process it. B, I didn't have a safe space. So you speak about it as a parent. Now I'm a parent, so giving my daughters that safe space is paramount. Like, it's the biggest thing I can do.
First of all, amazing dad, and I think the girls are going to be incredibly lucky to have you as the man that's raising them. I think you guys are very fortunate, and I'm so excited still for the life you have ahead. And there is, I want people to know, like, there is this real wonderful story that comes from this, but right. Let's get through the shitty stuff first, because I'm really, like, we'll get through the shitty stuff, because I think what will really inspire people is how there is this massive, like, change of, like, this door opening and, like, light, like, tons and tons of light coming in. This experience happened, you're 8. But you're still not, it's not like you're, like, this goody two-shoe kid that kind of keeps going. Like, you definitely have a little bit of shit, a little troublemaker in
Absolutely,
you.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot that goes with it. Raised by a single mom, there were a couple, you know, it wasn't always the most stable of places. And yet, through all this, you managed to land on your feet. I mean, you've got some good brains, and you've got some
really
ethic. Like, you got lucky, because you ended up in some amazing places.
I did.
Despite the circumstances.
I did, yeah.
So take us from, like, let's do, like, a really quick Coles Notes version of, you kind of get your life in as much order that you can get through school, get some things done.
Mom pretty much kidnapped me from my dad when I was very young, from an abusive relationship. So she never took any money. So we were always pretty destitute. And I say poor. And that's, I mean, the definition of poor, I think, is you miss meals and you have to rely on charity. So we did that. So we didn't have much. She was very loving. Mom was very loving her entire life. It's just, I think she was confused and young. I went from, it's funny, I have all my report cards still, and my had straight A's up until then, and then, you know, he's daydreaming, he's not here, he's not participating right after. I claw my way through school. I get in a little trouble in my late teens, where I stole a car, and then I get involved with these people, and I get arrested, and but I get through that, and I don't go to jail. I get accepted to Carleton, and the judge took it easy on me, so I didn't end up going to jail. I ended up going to university instead. That didn't take, but I did get, you know, come to Ottawa. Born in Montreal. All this stuff happens in Hamilton. And I come to Ottawa, which I just fall in love with. I have an aunt and uncle who are super, super supportive and kind. I talk about them in the book as well. And working a lot of odd jobs here and there. And then I start working at Foot Locker, which I fall in love with because I do so well. I'm able to put on the mask. I'm able to, like, sell shit. And, like, I was nationally ranked 2 years in a row, which from Ottawa was, you know, beating the Toronto boys was a big deal. And then I wanted more. And I was always good with doing the work, even if it was an addiction of sorts, right? So I was not good at personal relationships or social situations, and but I was really good at doing the work. And and I got ambitious, you know. I was working in a coffee shop in the first, you know, from 5 a.m. to 9 a.m., Foot Locker 9 a.m. to 6 p.m., and then busing across the Algonquin to take courses in programming 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. So it was just, my entire day was full. So doing the work.
Right. But if your entire day is full, then you don't have to think about things.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right? If you keep yourself busy, then you're constantly outrunning the dark shadow that's constantly chasing
it's,
you.
It's as much an addiction as anything else. And that was one of the big epiphanies in my life, in my book, is I always had something to look at. And we didn't have internet back then. I didn't have a smartphone either. It's just, you know, our society has made it abundantly easier to not look within. I worked through that, and I won an essay contest, actually. So I achieved this Microsoft solution developer an engineering certificate through it, and got hired. And then I bought out my went into massive debt, bought out my boss, and worked my ass off to build that company, and made a pretty good. That's when we first met. You know, I had a good lifestyle company then, and then I met one of my partners. We got along really well. He came aboard with his companies, and he had founded Founderound Boxing Club, and he was the originator of Fight for the Cure. So I helped that just sort of as a friend, and then helped marshal that along over the years. I just was really lucky. And the addiction, the work addiction, I think was the reason I was able to claw myself out of it.
Right. You have this work addiction that, you know, you're able to build onto a company and then join in with another company and become a co-founder of what is now, as I mentioned, like a $500 million company. So you're really good at putting in the work, or putting in a certain type of work at one point that made sense, right? Like you were really good at one point at what you did.
Yes. Yeah.
You weren't so good towards the end.
wasn't great at the end.
No.
No. No.
So where in this of you, let's get into asset, right? So you've built up a couple of companies. You're at this point, you've married to your first wife. Let's go through the timeline.
Okay.
Because in this point of as successful as you're getting, there are other habits that are starting to kind of creep in a little.
This podcast is brought to you by Extension Marketing. They are a new breed of marketing agency that acts as your virtual marketing department, designing and implementing cost-effective marketing strategies that will grow your business. I can speak to this personally, as I've been using the Extension Marketing team to help me launch and grow my business. Founder Pat Whalen has been a lifesaver for me, a genuine coach guiding me along the way into uncharted territory. Tell them you're a friend of the show and receive a free 1-hour consultation. Check them out at extensionmarketing.com.
I mean, I was checking off all the things. So the nice car, the nice house, the nice wife, and thinking happiness will come with it. And, you know, we hear more often than not, that's not how you do it. life isn't a checklist.
Yeah, but it wasn't just like a nice, like it was like a really nice car. And a really, like, let's not downplay it, right? It's, like, yeah. I mean, there's not many that we see, like there's, we don't seem to see that wealth here, but that came with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was a part of it. And my ex, attributes my downfall to that car and that lifestyle, to start drinking, start going out to clubs.
People want to be around you.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
I mean, you're a nice guy. I know how nice, but they weren't wanting to be around you just for the sake of, oh my God, you have to hang out with Rob because he's just really,
well, I think I like to think, well, I mean, they definitely were probably attracted by the things, but I like to think they stayed because I was nice.
Right.
Was real.
Yes. There are some friends that we're going to learn, like that were really good. And then some that, you know, I'm sorry, but the Vegas girls, they weren't sitting there at the end of their shift going, he was such a nice guy to talk to.
Fair.
Yeah, Am I allowed to say that? Okay.
Yeah.
So when did the lifestyle start to kind of overtake a little bit?
I think, I thought I was doing a great job, but,
of course.
The lies we tell ourselves. I think I was doing ecstasy, my drug of choice, and I was doing a lot of them. But this one really messes with your emotions. So, you know, it gives you a high, you're happy, you're in love with the world. But then you're doing it so often, you forget what's real and you don't know what's real. And then, but you know you don't know what's real. So I just lost complete confidence. Like I was at one point speaking to Algonquin grads and love speaking to groups and people. And to the point where I couldn't hold a meeting with 5-10 people in my own company. Like I just didn't have the confidence. I was gone. Like the lights were out.
Which is so tough to be.
And
so
my partner
successful.
Saw it. My partner saw it. You know, to their credit. You know, they tried to help and they tried to. They didn't know nothing what was going on, but they knew that I was becoming ineffective and something was amiss. And they hired people. We hired people to help me. And along the way, that did end up helping when I started healing. You know, we did hire someone that was great, and I was able to find my place and you know, get my confidence back and be more effective.
Yeah, but we got a while to go until we're back into the healing part. I know that you're going to jump ahead, but I'm not going there yet. Because I know in the course of writing this book, a lot of the research for this book was calling up credit card companies and backtracking and researching and trying to get a full understanding of what the behavior, what the patterns were really like. When you're having to go back over credit card statements and go, oh, this is what I spent. This is where I was. This is when you were having to go and research that way. That's it's in front of you.
Yeah. I mean, I was good in. Well, good. In that I used only Expedia. So I saw all the trips and then I saw the reasons why and festivals and raves and that sort of thing. And then, yeah, the credit card. Yeah, you can't look away from that. And you're like, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah. And like I have a chapter, like 30% of this book is gone. I've cut it because it just would be too long. And I condensed it. And then there was a time I did this and this time, and, you know, I'm passed out in this club washroom and this, you know, my security guys has to take me, you know, to the car and just talk about rock bottom.
Right. And there's enough of it in there to get a really good sense, because you get a sense of that you had when you would go to Las Vegas, like you had security people around you. You were a high roller. There was, there were things that came that I think for many of us, we just don't comprehend. We're not familiar with that life. I played the slot machines when I went to Vegas.
As I've been to Vegas, I've never gambled. I just dropped my money off and left, I guess. But I was really, I loved the ecstasy and the friends. I made some really good friends, you know, I've since ostracized. But we had a great crew that went out all the time. And I love that feeling, you know, I can touch happiness for a few hours.
You could. But I want to put it into perspective. So people listening, this Vegas, this party lifestyle, this really did occur after we found you catatonic on the floor.
Yeah.
So all of this is the progression. There's a divorce. There's a separation. Mm-hmm. How long would you say from the time that you are catatonic on the floor and the memory is now full live in color and on replay? Take us through a timeline if you can.
In a few short weeks, maybe a couple of months, my wife and I split up, and you know, to her credit, she wanted to stay, but there was more going on. Like I was cheating, and you know, all the same behaviors that I was going through, and I wasn't a good husband. And I had started just going downtown and reaching out to just having dinners with friends and wanting to go out and just get drunk. That's how it started. And, I had tried, oh, that's right. I was invited to go to to Vegas for my first time. I've never been to Vegas. I had never been actually interested in going to Vegas before this. But I had introduced a friend to his wife and he insisted that I go to the bachelor party. And I'm in the midst of this breakup. And we go out, we're out in the club. And one of the guys is like, did you want some Coke? I'm like, no, I'm anti-drug, don't really do anything. And then he's like, would you like some ecstasy? And I describe it to the T in the book. Like, I had tried it once, like 5 years ago, and it's like literally like the only drug I've done in my entire life. And I loved it, but then it took me 2 weeks to get over it, and I was sick. I'm like, oh, it was a fun, whatever. But I was, you know, it was self-destructive. I was a little drunk. I'm like, yeah, why? Like, why not? and I did it. And then that was it. I just sort of fell in love with that drug, and that entire night is in the book, and that parlays into maybe 4 years of it. So once I'm hooked on that, and it goes through, I won't do it in Ottawa because I don't want anyone to know about it.
Right. You kept this life quite private. I mean, yeah.
I didn't want to be caught, you know, doing drugs, you know, in Ottawa. I was, I was on some boards of charities at the point as well. I just didn't want, you know, that stigma, and I didn't know how to handle it. And then I started doing it in Montreal. So, you know, it's still out of town, but it turned out to be with my Ottawa friends anyway. And then it just sort of started doing it all the time.
Okay. So I think we've created this picture.
Yeah.
I hope we've created this picture.
Yeah.
When does it go from you going to parties, you're going to Montreal, you're now addicted to ecstasy, you're kind of on a 4-year bender of, you know, mm-hmm. of this high. When do you realize that it's out of control? Or that you're starting to realize that you don't have control over what you thought you did?
I mean, this was all, I considered it to be part of my downward spiral to death. So I had every intention of ending my life. And this was just some fun I'm having on my way out. I think a part of me was spending all the money I had so I wouldn't have anything left would be kind of like cheating on your wife. And you're like, okay, well, I'm burning that bridge and I have no reason to live. And I think that was...
So if all the money is run out too, then the money's
gone.
Why live?
I have nothing to... Yeah, not... Whatever. Kind of a dick thing for me to do because I probably could have left it to some people, but... or donated it. I think it was my, I reached out, I finally, I think after 3 years, I reached out and got a therapist. And that's a story in itself, but I found someone that, saw through my bullshit and didn't put up with my bullshit. And, so I liked her right away. And, she gave me carte blanche. She's like, oh, if you think you need to do MDMA, you know, go ahead and do it. If you're feeling, I think, want to know why you want to do it, and then we'll talk about it in your next session. And I think that was just her evil genius, you know? So now I'm feeling shitty. I'm like, okay, I just want to pop some pills. I'm like, why do I want to pop some pills? And so a few times I would stop and realize, why do I want to do this? And that just, I think, just got everything firing. Why am I doing this? Why am I living this lifestyle? And I need help.
Had you had the discussion though with her about the memory, like what you were running from?
Right away. I interviewed a lot of psychiatrists, and the one I landed on, when I did land on her name's Anne, she's since retired, I decided to be 100% raw and honest. I'm like, if I'm going to bother spending this much money, if I'm going to bother, I have to do this. And I told her, I was like, listen, I'm a world-class bullshitter. I'm like, I am not who I say I am to almost everybody. Well, to everybody. I'm having trouble with this. I treat people like this. I don't want to do this anymore. And then this is what's happened. This is what so I just sort of just laid it all out. And that took a few weeks just to lay it all out. And then we started working from there.
Is this before or after the attempt?
This was after two attempts.
Mm-hmm. So it's a call for action. Mm-hmm. It's a call, like, you know, there's a recognition of being able to do this. What would you say to her? Because I find that there's a launching point, right? Like you say, she gave you this carte blanche, and yet there were times when you chose not to order from it.
What would I say to her when I
didn't? Like, you know, when, like, the style, like, there was something to it.
Right.
You having an option.
I didn't know it back then. I only realized it when I was writing the book. I just, she was that good, I think. I would just say I don't know why, I just decided not to, right? And I'm like, I guess I didn't need to, because I was thinking about why do you need to this? Well, and I would make something up. Well, this means I'm going to have to go out. I'm going to have to be social. I'm going to have to get ready. Okay. I'm going to feel like shit for the next 3 days. Or I'm going to continue doing it and I'll feel like shit all next week. I guess I just, whatever, I'll stay in and not do it. I would always come up with something, you know, plausible. And I didn't know, right? I didn't know at the time. I think she was just trying to open the door.
I'm going to fast forward a little bit because I find that the triggers that kind of help with the healing are really, really important to the story. But there are some really special people along the way. And I don't want to get into too many personal details, but there are people who saw you through part of this journey that are with you and that could have their own version of the story mm-hmm. to tell as well, right? But that I think play a big role.
For sure. Yeah. There are people I have reestablished relationships with, you know, just sort of being vulnerable and reaching out and saying, listen, I know I was like this, but and I miss our friendship, but I just want to say, you know, I love you. And I wrote, you know, you're in the book as well. And more recently I did connect with a really good friend of mine, and funnily enough, funnily is not a word, but funny enough, the reason we broke up as friends were not the reason I thought, you know, it was still on me. It was still me being dick, but for different reasons. It wasn't about the drugs. He just knew I was suffering and he was going through his own journey, and now we reconnected. And other people, other friends that I described in the book who helped me tremendously, we're still not talking. And that's okay. We're on our own different journeys, but I hope that they read this and know that, you know, I'm sorry.
There's also a love interest. There's also a powerful tool of someone who stood by and, mm-hmm. you know, you have two wonderful children with, but you're really good in private of keeping much of Myra's aspect to it. But
Myra's a private person, mm-hmm. And it's her story to tell, not mine. So I, you know, I have my own and she has her own, you know, she's definitely the hero. In my book. I just wanted to respect that for sure.
I think you did a really good job, but for her to understand, she's known both sides of you.
You know, we we went through ups and downs, and we broke up for a while, and instead of, you know, turning vile, she turned to love, and she's like, you know, you have a problem. So yeah, she and we still, even though we were separate, she went to Toronto. She came back. You know, we tried things out, tried dating, you know, just sort of arm's length for a while. Still struggling, still, you know, going back and slipping, and then out of nowhere, we weren't even together. We were both high. In those moments, you know, we would talk to each other, and she would say, you know, like, I just want a boring life. I don't want all this stuff, and I just want, you know, boring. And like, a boring sounds really nice. And we were kind of like in close talking, and we said it over and over again. We're not going to do it again. We're not going to do it again. And then we just decided to. And I asked her to marry me when we're high. And she says yes. We get married 2 weeks later, fly to Vegas, bring our parents, bring our siblings. And, it was on conditions, right? We sell the penthouse downtown. We buy a nice house in the suburbs. No more of this partying stuff. We have to give it up. And I said, check, check, check. That's it. Yeah, okay. We're going to do it. And we did it. And that's the big thing about this journey. And we slipped, right? There, you know, once in a while we did slip. And that's the big thing where, you know, we went from, you know, one step forward to four steps back to one steps forward to two steps back and to we'll take two steps forward and one step back. And we just kept on going forward. And she stayed.
She did. But I think in this journey, the amount of steps that you started to take forward it didn't seem like there was any need to take any steps back. And I think what was interesting is that this is not a 12-step program. Mm. Like the way you just described it is there was an end, right? Because the leaving Las Vegas thing didn't work.
No.
It didn't. Like you couldn't drink yourself. You failed to drink yourself to death.
You came
pretty close.
I started literally having fun, right? So it just turned about to fun and figuring out how I was going to kill myself, you know, be it in the middle of a rave or, you know, hanging myself in my condo. That was like a side thought. I was started to have fun, but all produced by the drugs, obviously.
Right. The fun leads into... there is, you know, but it is because when I was reading this, I'm like, okay, well, there's no 12-step program that you accomplished. And then you said to me, okay, well, I have checked.
I've checked all the boxes
of a 12-step program. So what was the start of kind of going through the getting everything out of the system?
Therapy was the big one. And I don't advise not going to, just so you know, a 12-step program. Had I been able to be strong and vulnerable enough, I would have. Therapy was a big one, and she encouraged me to do group therapy, something I'm doing now after avoiding for 9 years. I think I had Myra, right? She's kind of like my sponsor and always being there. Spirituality was a big one. I started doing meditation, which I entered kicking and screaming. I think you have a similar experience.
We have a very similar story, but I think what I appreciate with you is that you had some emotional reactions to the
for
meditation, because
sure.
You didn't feel deserving of
may things be good today.
Yeah, you know, so mm-hmm. So take us through, because I think let's go check off some of the things on the box and have stories that mm-hmm. help kind of relate to it. One of them was,
well, meditation,
Myra, right? Like, you guys started
Myra,
doing this
sure.
Yeah, this meditation. She's like, okay, so here you are, like, let's try to do this. And
well,
even
that was Myra
that,
saying, let's try to do
yes,
this.
And, then, and you kicking and screaming.
I'm like, okay, what do you want to do? She says, I'm just going to lay the phone on the pillow in the morning and at night. And it was like, it was 5 minutes. And yeah, like that may things be good today. It was in the morning and it was on the pillow. This is in the book
in the
as
book.
Well.
So may things be good today.
May things be good today. That's
that was,
all
that
that's
was
all
the mantra.
Woman said. Yeah.
That's all she said.
That's all she said. May things be good today. And I'm like, oh, okay, this is great. Yeah. I hope things are good today. And may things be good today. Cool. May things be good today. Like, okay, why? And then it turned into may things be good today. I was just like, fuck off. Stop. Sorry if I said I'm not allowed to swear. And may things be good today. And I was just like, not that I said the words, I don't feel worthy, but I'm like, I just started to cry. And I hid it from Myra and I ran into the washroom and I'm like, yeah, thanks. That was a good meditation. And, you know, just sort of let it try to wash over me.
Why such an impact on a may things be good today?
Definitely not letting myself be truly, truly happy, like not being deserving of things happening, being good that day. And just having a voice, a random voice out of the air, wishing me well, was so foreign. It's just so it's so uncomfortable. I had to get away from it.
So how do you sit back and press play the second day of going from may things be good today to...
Deep breaths. I'm like, okay, I'm just... And I think there's a little bit of dissociation there. I knew it was going into. I think I'm going to ignore it, I think. But it's, as you know, it pierces through the armor. Just those mantras, you know, things like that just pierce. They actually, you know, I absorb them and... we absorb them. I think it just started working, and I fell in love with meditation, as you know, and that turned into something a lot more.
Was there ever a sense of you craving, or, you know, being in this, as you were going to kind of do the quotations, boring, starting venturing into this boring life? Could you be sitting in a meditation going, ugh, I wish I was just at a club in Vegas right now, high on ecstasy? You know, when you go the back and forth of, you know, there have been times to slip, or am I keeping it open-ended, like, well, if I wanted to, I could go back, but let's just do the breathing for today. Like,
that's exactly how it was. And I mean, we told ourselves, you know, every Monday, okay, no more. We're going to take a few weeks off. By Thursday, something's going on. You know, there's a friend's birthday. There's a club celebration. We know we're just getting all these invites. We're like, okay, we'll go out, maybe just have a couple of drinks. And bam, we're on a plane, or we're in Montreal, or we're doing something ridiculous. And then all of a sudden it's Monday again. In sitting in the meditation, sometimes we're just like, hey, we're, you know, craving it. Or a lot of times we're just like, this is so nice. This is just, let's have something healthy to eat, and let's just chill for a while. And I think the momentum started building just from there, from that simple 5-minute meditation. And for me, I need to investigate and research everything. I did a deep dive into how meditation works. And I was like, okay, this is affecting my physiology. This is affecting my neurochemistry. This is pretty amazing stuff. There's a lot more out there. And I'll do the work. And I'm like, okay, let's go do this. No, we did the Transcendental Meditation course, the TM course, together. And that was great. So it forced us to do it 40 minutes a day, so 2 20-minute sessions. And so we were doing that. And that turned into learning more. And then that I tipped my toe into Buddhism, which is my spirituality checkbox of the mm-hmm. Of the 12th step. So it just turned into something more, that meditation.
Okay. Now I'm also looking at you, and you know, for somebody who's listening or those that might watch this on YouTube, like, you're a very thin, fit, you know, person that I'm looking at. And I think what people need to realize is that this wasn't you. This is not the reality of what you were back in that time.
Another reason I'm surprised that, you know, Myra stayed was definitely because she's beautiful, and I was 60 plus pounds heavier than I am now, for sure. I was pre-diabetic. I was, you know, great candidate for heart disease. It runs in my family, and just wasn't in good shape. So yeah, I mean,
plus you were lazy. Like, I mean, aside, for like, sure. I don't mean like you had plenty of energy out at night at a party, but you could be
working as hunched over a laptop.
Right. And then on the couch, depressed and not moving.
Recovering from the weekend. So yeah, ordering shitty food, you know, watching TV, or yeah, that's pretty much the lifestyle.
Speaking of the food, I know that you went clean.
Did a deep dive into nutrition.
Very clean, yeah.
Just because I had to. Like, there's just so much shit out there, and I tried so many different things. So I needed to know what was right for my body. So I just really did a deep dive. Actually, my wife and I are doing a plant-based nutrition certification at Cornell starting tomorrow, just because we love the lifestyle so much. So it's just nice knowing the science. And then I baselined all my blood markers, all my biomarkers, and tried.
I know, but I just look at that, a person who's so concerned with their blood markers and their, you know, have they taken the time to breathe and doing these morning mantras. Like, it's a very different individual mm-hmm. from and mindset to someone who you would have looked back on couple years ago. And it's like, what and what drug are we getting? Well, it wasn't like a cocktail for you. You knew what you liked. That could you see the comparison of being in that one situation and then seeing it, this individual who emerges of who you are now, and see any?
I mean, it could be, you know, an element of neurosis that, you know, in that I was just obsessed with dying and partying and being that person, and now I'm kind of like somewhat obsessed with being super healthy, being a really good father to my daughter, my daughters, and a really good husband to my wife. So there's a line in a book, Sharon Salzberg. She writes these amazing books. I think you've heard the name because you've read 10% Happier. And she says, people tell you to love yourself, but they don't tell you how. And it really resonated with me. That's true. That's, you know, people throw these tropes all over the place, and they don't actually tell you how. Like, you should just be healthier. I'm like, okay. You know, wow. If someone's just, you should just be a gymnast. Oh, okay. Thanks. Right? I need to know how. So I needed to learn how to love myself. I needed to learn how to nourish myself nutritionally. I need to know how. I had to get off my ass and go to the gym. I'm like, okay, so I'm going to get a trainer to help me. I'm going to go online. I'm going to see what's best for my boss. Try all this stuff. Meditation was no different. You know, when I discovered loving kindness meditation, it changed my life. When I discovered the gratitude journal, it changed my life.
I think a gratitude journal is a very different writing. Writing a suicide letter and writing a gratitude journal, I think, are almost the two exact opposite spectrums. How much joy do you get, or what do you intend? What's your intention when you sit down to write in the gratitude journal?
A big part of it's ritual. I need that ritual in the morning. I think it changes my mindset for the day. Let's do this in the morning. Yeah. Because you can wake up in any mood, you know, based on what you're dreaming, or, you know, if a toddler's wake you up by kicking you in the face several times, which I get a lot. You're out of coffee. That never happens, but in case that ever happens, I write what I'm grateful for. It just sets the tone for the day. It sets the tone with how you treat people, how you react, you know, if you want to respond and not react. So you're just sort of more aware of, you know, this. If my wife and I have an argument, you know, we'll both step back and like, that really wasn't worth saying. I shouldn't have said that. This is not worth, you know, whatever. So, because we're always on the same page. So.
So that goes in the journal.
That goes in the journal. Yep.
So in this, and if we're doing the 12-step checklist, spirituality.
Yep.
You have different outlets. So it's, I would think, through your meditation, through your exercise, mm-hmm. you're spending time in the kitchen, yep. you're cooking
self-love.
Healthy. Self, yep. Yeah, there's the big one, is self-love. Mm-hmm. There's the facing it. And I know, well, I haven't been through a 12-step program, but when you say you checked off most of the boxes, there's the conversations, the hard conversations, or the going to people. But the first one would have been tough, is going to mom and actually explaining how this domino effect really stems from something that happened a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah, it's a difficult conversation, and I tried to tell her, and she, you know, in person, face to face, it's like, okay, tell me only what I need to know. And she didn't want to know everything. And I didn't want to tell her everything because I didn't want to upset her too much. There I am protecting her again. And I gave her the manuscript and she decided to read it on the plane. I didn't realize she was going to do this, but she's going to read it on a plane flying out to Edmonton to see.
She really didn't know the full story until she read this.
Yeah. And she was just beside herself on this plane, and she's freaking out, going through her own trauma, and having to deal with that through the plane. And that was really difficult for me to hear. But she went to, you know, her brother and her brother's wife, who were, you know, she went to a loving place. She had a safe place for a few days to digest it and then come home. We've had a lot of conversations about it.
You've mentioned, just because I noticed, but you've mentioned a lot the word safe space.
Yeah.
What is, for you, how do you define that? Or how should people be able to define their safe space?
It's, I guess, a place, not a, you know, just an abstract place. Just being with someone without judgment, without, like, you know, you and I, you know, develop a friendship, we can say, and we have gone through the book, we can say things in a place where we know we're not going to judge each other. We're not going to, we can open up, you know, as far as our friendship would take us, type thing. And there's no having to go any further, right? If my daughters, you know, think they're come out trans or gay or something, I want them to be able to be comfortable enough to know that I'm going to love them no matter what. Right? That's a safe space.
So what if someone had created a safe space for you 6-7 years, right? Let's go years back, and a safe space, and said, Rob, here's your safe space. You need help. Let us offer you this safe space. Could you have taken it then? What do you tell somebody listening who's been listening to your story and fears that a loved one of theirs is in turmoil? How do they offer up that safe space? Because that person's, they mm-hmm. got to enter into it, right?
They do.
So how, what would have worked, or could there have been something, or how does one go about
it? I mean, there was, right? And it's Myra. She gave me that safe space by staying. I got permission to say this. She was brought up in group homes. Her parents owned group homes and helped these kids, these troubled youth. And a lot of these troubled youth would act out and you know, do damage. And their job was to let them know that they're staying, you know, they're going to stay. And when I asked my wife, you know, why did you stay through all those years? She's like, that's what you do. You stay, you know, you show love. And that's a safe space. That she was my safe space for me. Even through our breakup, she was still there. Like, there's an earlier version of the book where I have this, you know, 12-page letter that she wrote me. And it's all love, you know. And this is a breakup letter after we broken up, and just saying, it didn't make the book, but that was my safe space. And then I had some in some friends who I confided in. I had some in my therapist, I have them with Buddhism. You know, I really resonated with the idea that there's a, you know, an inner Buddha nature in me, that no matter what you've done and no matter who you are, you have this perfect being inside you. That's Buddhist practice. And there's a framework for living to get to that. So I think that another, it's gave myself a little bit of a safe space.
I think you're hoping to create that as well. The writing, this was one piece of writing, mm-hmm. but I know that the writing, it's in you. Like you wrote even as a child, but you're continuing to write and research. And just like you dove into, okay, let's learn more about meditation. Let's learn more about healthy eating. Mm-hmm. You know, you've looked more into repressed memory and the topics and the discussion, the science, the dialogue around it. So where do you hope? Are you hoping that there's more dialogue? Are you hoping to create safe spaces for other people? How do you take what you're now launching and then hope to have an impact or to be able to offer other people spaces or places to go where they could heal?
I
know that's a lot. That's
there's a lot.
Big question throughout there.
I mean, on the surface, you know, half of all the proceeds is going to a treatment center for adults with childhood sexual abuse. I'm doing a group there, so I'm also a client. I think the research that I conducted, and I'm still doing it, still learning a lot about trauma. And there's a book I'm reading now that my therapists recommend because they read it, called The Body Keeps the Score. And in it, there's this trauma therapist, and he says, you know, in the literature, it only says like 1 in 100,000, you know, women go through this child sexual abuse. And if I do the math, I'm like, why are 47 of them in my clinic, right? And it was obscene. It just didn't make sense. So it's prevalent. It's everywhere. And it's boys and girls. Now they're saying, you know, 1 in 6 boys, 1 in 4 girls have been abused. And those are the only ones who were brave enough to say something. So I think it could be greater than that, right? And that's a conversation worth having. I think it's very related to Me Too, the Me Too movement. I think it really is, because it, like Joaquin Phoenix says, right? It's about, you know, one group reigning over another with impunity. So, and it's a power struggle. So I think the conversations, I think there is power in awareness. And I don't want to seem all doom and gloom. I really subscribe to, you know, Steven Pinker's, we're in the best time of our species existence. That said, that's enabling us to uncover all these things that have been happening and going on for all these years. And now we can shed some light on it. And we're learning a lot more about healing. We're learning a lot more about trauma. And we hope that there, you know, we're going to have transition parents, is what they call someone like me, you know, ending cycles of abuse. So we can empower that. And yeah, I'm working with the center, and I hope to bring this to light a bit more.
That's really interesting. Transition, what's the...
Transition parents or transition person, which is... You know,
but it's interesting, right? It's putting the end to the cycle. Yeah. It is dealing with the trauma and finding its healing it, mm-hmm. so that it doesn't continue to get passed on. Because as we are learning, trauma is passed on from generation to generation. Well, there's the epigenetic, like it mm-hmm. is transferred to us, mm-hmm. and so it's taking responsibility to heal yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, you speak epigenetics. So we can control how those genes are expressed. With someone like a transition parent, I can turn them, again, I can make sure they're not activated.
And are you having the discussions? I mean, I know the group therapy, right? Like for a long time, you were just like, I can't do this.
Took
like,
me nine yeah. years.
9 years yeah, to get into.
To be brave enough. I had one trial I was describing in the book that just didn't, it just
didn't
went
take.
South. Didn't take, yeah.
So would you say that for people, like they might have gone into one meeting or tried one therapist, it didn't take. Sometimes it's not going to take on right. the first visit.
For sure. And I mean, especially therapists. I'm glad you brought that up. Interview therapists, because you're about to possibly share your life, your deepest, darkest secrets with someone. So that person you should probably be really comfortable with. You know,
Mm-hmm. No, it's okay. Because, you know, the fact that you're going to be speaking openly about this, this book is going to be here and you have two young daughters.
Yeah.
Have you thought about what it will be like for them to one day open it and say, Dad, let's talk about this?
Ad nauseum, yeah. I think when they're ready, I mean, I'm not going to hide it from them. And we're going to have a lot of good talks, I guess. It's safe space. This is what we went through. And know that we love you unconditionally. And this is where we are now.
There's going to be people reading this, and then they're looking for more. I hope, like, I'm going to put you through, like, kind of like a ringer right now, because I want people to take the most of this. What would be some of the books right off the bat after they read yours? Who do you suggest people read, or where do they go, or what books, places, podcasts? Because you do, I know that you're big into this. So give kind of like some of your top favorites as to things, places, speeches, people.
I mean, I'm a big fan of Rich Roll's podcasts. It's lifestyle. It's actually, I think you'd love Rich Roll just because he's like an ultra marathoner and kind of transitioned himself. I like Tim Ferriss still. I still love his, you know, Five Bullet Fridays type thing. I think Theo Fleury's book is revolutionary, you know, and his more recent book, where his conversations with a rattlesnake, which is, he describes the therapeutic process for him. If you want to get into the trauma, I think, yeah, The Body Keeps the Score is something that I'm reading now. There's another thing called the Inner Child Workbook. And it sounds cheesy, but we have this inner child. I have this little boy, this little 8-year-old that I have to talk to. And you write in one of the most heartbreaking things I've ever had to do is write to that little inner child with my right hand and let him know that he's loved and that he's okay and it's not his fault. And then respond through my left hand, writing cursive with my left hand. And that little boy has his own thought process, his own personality, and doing a lot of work with that workbook helps people work through that. It is profound. All these things that I thought were woo-woo and ridiculous have been incredibly profound.
Profound is big, you know. Woo-woo, yes.
Yeah.
I think for some, even us talking, you know, I think a lot of people are aligned and are seeing, especially with scientific research now behind it, right? There's more to believe in that meditation and the mind and neuroplasticity and rewiring the brain. But that is fascinating. I'm picturing you writing with one hand and then writing with the other. I mean, and in cursive. Like, that to me, like that,
it's
you
not
know,
very legible with my right hand, no. So that's much worse. I didn't really understand or respect the power of affirmations. I write this every single morning. I wanted to mention this to you. I write down, I love and respect myself. And I wrote this just as a woo-woo thing because I do my gratitude journal. And I didn't really, really respect how powerful it would be, because I look at it and when I first started writing it, I didn't love or respect myself. But in writing it every day, I literally inch by inch was like, how can I become that person that I respect and love? And what in my character do I have to change where I do love and respect myself? And it could be easy as, you know, I like radical honesty, you know, I like now just because I was such a bullshitter. I just like radical honesty. I'm like, okay, I'm just going to be honest 100% of the time.
From an epic bullshitter and forever,
for sure.
You know, that's a big... That's a big switch.
It is, yeah. And more often than not, it really solidifies relationships, friendships, and it's even just the slightest little thing, you know.
I love and respect myself.
I love and respect myself.
You wrote that every morning.
I still write it every morning. Yeah.
But you found the ways.
Yeah, for sure. And just to be clear, there's no end game for trauma, right? The end game is integrative. Like, it's integrated into my life. It's not gone. I'm not healed. And I don't believe people can be fully healed. I think it's going to be integrated, and you can live an amazing life. But it's there. You don't just delete.
No.
And so that's why it's a daily practice.
Yeah.
I told you earlier, I was listening to your podcast with
Tracy Bellows.
Yoga Town. So I'm super hyped about doing yoga now, because there's actually therapeutic benefit. There's
a ton. I mean, we could go through that again. I love that you're on, you know it.
Shout out to my sister, who's been a Bikram instructor for 15 years, and I'm finally doing my first hot yoga tomorrow. Sorry, and thank you. She said, we call it a practice. And I love that, you know, because there's no arriving, right? So is, you know, growing. So is getting over these things or integrating these things. It's a practice. I think we should go to Royal Ottawa and have them change the word.
To practice.
Therapy should be the practice.
It's the therapy is the practice.
Yeah.
And you're always practicing.
Yeah.
This is when I wish my podcast was like 2 hours, and then my listeners are going, okay, no, we're good with the hour, Leanne. Like, we got you for the hour. I'm excited about where you're going. You're not working. I could say you're like, I'm going to do the air quotes, the retired.
Yeah.
But you're studying at, is it Harvard? No, which is the new place you're,
okay. Harvard Extension School, yeah.
Harvard Extension School for your writing.
Yeah.
You're just taking this course now. I know what you named it. You said
I took the semester off to have a baby. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I should say that. Congratulations. Yeah, because it's a very busy house.
And I didn't have it. Now. My wife did.
Yes. Yeah. Myra had it. And your writing, I think you're focusing a lot more on getting more of the writing. Because I think if you read the book, you'll realize that you're a very talented writer.
Oh, thank you.
And where can people find the book?
It's going to be, on Amazon. So you have the digital copy, the hardcover, and soft copy on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and wherever, Google and all the online places. We did an audiobook, which is also going to be available on Audible, iTunes, and in Amazon as well.
It's out.
It's out.
I think this officially was like, okay, this is, someone's going to press play on this. Your story's out.
Yeah.
Does it feel good?
Feels great.
A little liberating?
Yeah.
Is that the wrong word? What would the word be?
I like liberating. Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think we spoke about it before, but I sent the friends and family have read it, and they've come back with, well, as friends and families would, which extraordinarily positive responses, and everyone reading it in under 48 hours, like you.
Okay, well, that's the thing. I wrote it, and you're saying people sat down to read it, and all of a sudden they're flying through it. Plus, I will say, for anyone that's in Ottawa, like, you recognize events.
Oh, right.
You recognize people. You recognize, you're talking about this gala that was on the front cover of the newspaper, right? Like, and you've met, you know, you've been not so... I'm going to let people read some of these. I'm going to save some of these stories for the book. Let's get to people reading the book, because there's a lot of things that happen that you're like, I knew this was happening, but you didn't realize what was happening behind the scenes. I'm going to leave it like, right?
Yeah.
There was a lot happening behind. It's because it's definitely worth the read. And I think for someone who is searching for something, there's a lot more in there. We touched on the surface, but especially in some of the meditations, some of the way you kind of really kind of traveled out and left work and left that environment and said, okay, this is where boring starts. And boring is pretty awesome, isn't it?
It's pretty awesome. Yeah. Yeah. Loving life for sure.
Yeah. Loving life.
Yeah.
The boring one.
The boring one.
Yeah. Yeah. In suburbia with two kids.
Just suburbia.
And it's like a gift.
It is every day.
Rob, great job.
Oh, thank you.
I hope people get it. So the book, once again, called Before I Leave You. And the only reason I'm shutting it down is because I looked at my timer.
Oh.
And we are so over. And Veronica's smiling. She's like, okay, you can wrap it up. So I just want to be able to say thank you so much to people that are listening. See, and it's so nice because you even have someone like Rob who would just listen to the full length of the Yogurtown one. I had some people love that one too. Yeah. See, people
I didn't
want to
be emotional, but the end was so emotional. I'm literally on my way here. I'm like, I know.
Life is practice. Thanks again for listening. And please continue to like and comment and share. Word of mouth, the best way to get this podcast out there. But it's so great that these stories are making an impact and people really, really enjoying them. And making and I think the call to action. You went and signed up for your first yoga.
I did. Yeah,
I love it. I'm going to have to call Tracy. Thanks so much, everyone. Have a great day. And thanks once again for listening to Living Your Life with Leanne Lang. Oh, my gosh.
Come on a journey like no other, where you will discover many rogues that will lead you to a happier, healthier, and more stress-free life. And the beauty is, you don't need any vacation time for this adventure. The journey will come to you. Join Avery Rich on your very own journey into yoga. Along the way, she will demystify yoga poses and guide you into a yoga posture or short sequence, all in less than 15 minutes. You have nothing to lose but stress. The Journey into Yoga podcast. It's not for people who like yoga. It's for people who don't like yoga. Follow or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or at averyrich.com.